Greetings, kindred witches. Welcome to this episode of Atomic Witchcraft.
Here, we share our experiences as we build a modern-day inclusive witchcraft practice rooted in nature seasons, celestial cycles, and the science of energy.
Join us as we build a craft that learns from our past, is rooted in our present, and works toward building a better future, all while connecting deeply to the earth and sky around us.
Let us begin a new era of witchcraft. Hi everyone, I'm Ash, an atomic witch walking an eclectic road since the 90s.
I'm Alyssa, about 20 years in and growing a mostly green path.
And I'm Jay, new to the practice, composing a bard witch's craft. Because witch weaves together many webs, past, present, and future, we'd like to acknowledge that we are currently practicing our craft on the lands of the Coast Salish peoples, specifically the Duwamish, Muckleshoot, and Puyallup tribes.
The Atomic team participates in Real Rent, and we encourage you to engage with and contribute to similar programs in your area.
Welcome to our grove, here at the Atomic Hearth. Now, let's get witchy.
Welcome back to the Atomic Hearth. As we approach the new moon, I'm kicking off my fourth and final topic of the year, diving into elixir magic, something I've enjoyed for some time now. I'll be taking my foundation of skills and experience in this area and seeing how I can expand into some new methods and approaches, and plan to end up with a drinkable spell to both enjoy and learn from in the process. I'll be sure to share the recipe in our Full Moon Focus part 2 of this topic so you can follow along yourself if it sounds interesting and delectable to you. Like last time, we will be featuring our usual segments as well, including Charting the Celestial, where we'll be talking the winter solstice, the Geminids meteor shower, Jupiter, the Pleiades, and the constellation Cetus. Our quarterly subject, which will be Season of the Witch, will explore ways to lean into the season of winter to round out this fourth installment of this segment. And finally, Resistance Radio, to bring you methods, mundane and magical, to connect your craft into community and activism. This month, we'll be talking about how to build up your skills in this moment of resistance and resilience amidst unpredictable times. So let's lift off into the cosmos with our first section, Charting the Celestial.
Eyes on the sky. What's in the sky for this coming new moon to new moon cycle? Tonight, you guessed it, December 14th, it's a meteor shower peak. The Geminids is the second to last one of the year, and one of the best shows of 2025, with up to 120 meteors per hour, many of them streaking across the sky in a bright yellowish color. The parent for the Geminids is not a comet like usual, but rather an asteroid named 3200 Phaethon, and its radiant is Gemini. They begin showing up in the sky around 9 or 10 p.m. and last until dawn. According to NASA, the best way to view the Geminids is laying back on a blanket with your feet pointed south. This is a great shower to enjoy with kids, since you can begin seeing them fairly early in the night. You can view the Geminids from either hemisphere. December 21st marks the solstice. Up here in the northern hemisphere, it is the winter solstice, the longest night of the year, marked by the return of the light the next morning. For us, it also marks the beginning of candle nights. After the solstice, the days grow longer bit by bit as winter progresses and we move slowly into spring. In the southern hemisphere, it is the summer solstice, the longest day of the year. This is the time to get out and enjoy the light before the wheel continues to turn and brings in the dark again. In addition to the solstice, December 21st is also the peak of the final meteor shower of the year, the Euricids. Our radiant point lies in the Little Dipper, so they can really only be seen in the northern hemisphere. The best time to see the Euricids is around 1 a.m., and hey, if you're staying up all night to mark the solstice, this can be a fun activity in the late hours. January 3rd, my goodness, is not only the first full moon of 2026, but the first supermoon, and the peak of our first meteor shower of the year, the Quanterids. A supermoon is when a full moon occurs when the moon is at its closest point to the Earth in its orbit. This makes the moon look bigger than usual, and has the potential to spur on higher than usual tides. Now, since the light from this moon is going to be so bright, it will impede the viewing of the peak of the Quanterids. This meteor shower can produce up to 100 meteors per hour and usually makes for a spectacular show. If you head out in the wee hours before dawn and block the direct moonlight with your hand or maybe a book and let your eyes adjust to the dark for a while, you might see some of the brighter meteors, but hey, no guarantees here. This time of year is great for planet viewing, and on January 10th, Jupiter will be at its closest point to the Earth, and it will be fully lit up by the sun, creating a nice bright spot in the night sky. This giant planet can be seen throughout the entire night, beginning by rising in the east as the sun sets and setting in the west by dawn. Midnight, no matter where in the world you are, Jupiter will be at its highest point, roughly around where the sun was at noon for you. You can see Jupiter with the naked eye, and I recommend using a space app to nail down its exact location, no matter the time you're stargazing. If you grab a pair of good binoculars, you can spot Jupiter's four largest moons, and with a telescope, even a backyard one, you can see the details of the planet, including a potential to spot the eye. In the Northern Hemisphere, winter is the season where the Pleiades lights up the sky from dusk to dawn. This is an open star cluster, one of the closest to Earth, and is made up of 1,000 confirmed objects. But from our planet, it looks like an asterism made up of only about 6 or 7 stars. In certain conditions, it can be hard to spot the faintest one, so sometimes it looks like there's just 6 stars. The Pleiades have so many stories about them from so many cultures around the world, as this night sky pattern can be viewed from nearly everywhere on our planet. This is, like Cassiopeia's M to me, one of those night sky objects that once you see it for the first time, it's hard to not keep spotting it. Sometime throughout the winter, head outside on a clear night. The main stars that make up the Pleiades are so bright that urban light or some moonlight won't render you unable to find it. If you are stargazing in the early evening, they will be in the eastern sky. If you are up late, they will be more westward. The easiest way to spot the Pleiades is by looking for the constellation Orion from episode 154 first. Use Orion's belt as a starting point, follow a line from that asterism on the side where his shield is, pass through Taurus and its reddish star Aldebaran, and end on a small patch of 6 to 7 stars in the night sky. There are the Pleiades. In the southern hemisphere, now is a great time to spot the great celestial whale, Cetus. Though in depictions, it looks more like a sea monster than how we think of a whale. This is the 4th largest constellation in our night sky and contains many objects among the stars, including over 25 galaxies that can be seen through a telescope, and M77, which is a spiral galaxy that can be observed through binoculars. The constellation's main asterism is made up of about 13 stars, with 5 making up a circle of the head, about 3 for the main body, and 5 more in a large circle for the tail. Now, Cetus may be our 4th largest, but it's not the brightest constellation, so you'll want some proper darkness for this viewing. No moon, little to no urban lights. Head outside and find Crux in the southern sky, then turn around 180 degrees to the north. Cetus is almost directly opposite Crux in the celestial sphere, so this makes it a little easier to find. It rises in the northeast in the early evening and sets around 2 a.m., so the highest point is closer to 9 or 10. Like the Pleiades, we can use Orion to help us find this constellation, as his shield faces the sea monster. But this is a tricky one, so have that app or star chart ready. On cloudless nights in winter, the stars always seem brighter to me than any time of year. Whether it's because it's a time of deep darkness, the sky is less hazy, or the cold just heightens the senses and makes everything seem sharper, this is my favorite time of year for stargazing. I have a memory as a young child being in Vermont in the depths of winter and going outside and seeing an endless river of stars, our Milky Way, in perfect, sparkling clarity. The wonder that I felt then is one I carry to this day. It drives inspiration, not just for myself, but for all people who gaze up.
While Orion's shield may be keeping the mighty Cetus at bay, his eyes focus on a closer spot among the cosmos, the gathering of starlight we call the Pleiades. Their connected tale is one of pursuit and sorrow, but before we tell it, let us take a moment to meet this gathering of divine sisters. Who were they, in story and song, to our many cultural lenses? Well, for millennia, this huddled mixture of bright and dim lights has captured imaginations, inspired hope, and invoked seasonal rituals. The Babylonians and Assyrians saw them as a symbol of family ties, a group moving as one across the sky, held together by strong bonds. The biblical book of Job even highlights the value in their connection to one another, with Job asking, "Canst thou bind the sweet influences of the Pleiades?" The Egyptians connected them to Hathor, goddess of motherhood, beauty, and love, and likely, very likely, arranged the seven chambers of the Great Pyramid of Giza in the Pleiades' honor. And in Japanese mythology, the group is known as Subaru, which means gathering, which did indeed inspire the name and the logo of a car manufacturer. But to the Greeks, the Pleiades were seven sisters of titanic birth, who to the cosmos were sent to their eternal safety. It is their tale, one intertwined with Orion's relentless pursuits and earned downfall, that we dive into today. Born of the Titan Atlas and the Oceanid Pleione, the seven daughters were all beautiful and all unique. A brief introduction to each is the least we can do to begin. Maia was the eldest and brightest of the group, with the month of May still carrying her honor. By Zeus, she gave birth to the god Hermes. Taygeta was known as the mistress of the animals, and by Zeus, conceived Lacedaemon, founder of Sparta. Alcyone and Celaeno shared a connection to the sea, and, separately, had three children each with the god Poseidon, several of which would rule islands and kingdoms throughout the lands. Sterope was of a warrior's mind and found connection with the war god Ares. Their offspring would lead to the birth of Agamemnon, who led the sacking of the city of Troy. This was a point of contention with Electra, whose son Dardanus would found the Trojan kingdom earlier. Aghast at the fall of Troy, she fled from her sisters so that she might not have to gaze on the destruction. She gained the title, the Lost Pleiad, for this reason, and shares this title with the last sister here to meet, depending on your tale. Merope chose to marry a mortal man, differing from her sister's mutual interest in the divine. Unfortunately, it was to Sisyphus, the crafty king of Corinth whose scheming would earn him a sentence of eternal punishment. In marrying and procreating with a mortal man, Merope became mortal, and as mortals do, began to fade away. All seven were Titanesses, the daughters of the giant Titan Atlas, and as such they were held in esteem as they grew up, pursued their interests, and grew their families far and wide. But all would change upon the Titanomachy, the giant great war between the Olympians and the Titans, which the Titans would come to lose. In punishment for betraying Olympus through this war, Atlas was forced to carry the heavens upon his great shoulders for all time. This precarious and perpetual punishment is seen in myths involving the great heroes Hercules and Perseus, the latter of which we've shared here together once before. But for the hunter Orion, this meant the prey he most desired were finally free to pursue. Having lusted after the seven sisters for years upon years, his arrival on the mountain where they dwelled was both intense and reckless. The sisters knew right away and found a tight copse of trees to gather within for a moment, fearful but focused on how best to deny and deflect their unwanted intruder. In that moment, a mighty bear stepped in among them, and in a flash, became the skilled and steadied frame of their protector, the goddess Artemis. She said, "I take no pleasure in the truth of the hunter Orion's abilities. He is strong, he is skilled, and you will not outrun him in these forms. Doves of swift feathers, however, may be lithe and quick enough. If they are not, I will do whatever I can to ensure your safety. Now, my companions, take flight." The Pleiades nodded to their wise protector, and in the form of seven doves with golden wings, they slipped away just as Orion's footfalls grew near. The chase began and lasted for hours, and soon it was clear that while Orion might never catch them, this pursuit might have no end. Artemis, foreseeing what was necessary, did two things. First, out of the mountain itself, she conjured up the mighty beast Scorpio to finally give Orion a real challenge. It would prove his last, as you know from a past our story's tale. Second, reluctantly, she placed a request with Zeus to do what was needed. As Zeus waved his hand, the seven doves turned skyward and sped away, far, far away from Orion's grasp. As stars upon the heavens, the sisters would now be in eternal safety and placed together to both hold each other close and hold sorrow for their father Atlas, who could never look up to see them again with the heavens held up by his own mighty arms. So gaze with relief, but also shared grief, of the seven sisters who gather above. May they remind us of three important things: to protect those you love, to remember those past, and that journeys are best made together. And so these stories are told, drawn from the crisscrossing arcs and swirls above our magical minds. The cosmic cornucopia calls us to lie back, look up, and let our minds wander and wonder. As cultures around their world map their skies in a wonderful diversity of stories and interpretations, we encourage you to learn about the stories in your culture and of the ancestors on the land on which you reside.
Our night sky is filled with celestial objects, and while comets and meteor showers dazzle us with their spectacle, it is the constant spiral of our planetary dances that has long since shaped our story of the astrological through the telescope of astronomy. Our planetary siblings, each unique in their own orbit, personality, and inner essence, shines uniquely along their orbits, dancing along our elliptical. During these winter skies, Jupiter, the sage, moves along their solar path from east to west, its closest path to Earth, all while enjoying some solar spotlight. But Jupiter is more than just a dazzling spectacle of the night sky. There is new evidence that suggests that Jupiter played an important role in Earth becoming a planet, because Jupiter isn't just a gaseous planet, it's a failed star, and the first planet to form in our solar system. Yet, in its failed effort to become, its gravitational fields protected the orbits around it, allowing other planets like ours to form with all the elements needed for us to become. Even in its failure to form a star, it made way for life, and in the process created something magnificent, the largest and first planet in our solar system. This giant doesn't rest, though, as its rotation is a mere 9.9 Earth hours for one daily cycle. Perhaps what makes it easier is that, unlike Earth with a heavy iron core, Jupiter is actually hollow inside, filled with gases, and consists of layered bands that continuously interact, and in doing so, the notorious red spot, or storm, is created as the friction between the chemicals and the atmospheric layers interact. Now, there are other factors at play here, the chemical compounds, and how the rotation of Jupiter is at such a speedy pace it actually creates a bit of a mid-planet bulge, adding more pressure to those layers of friction. Because Jupiter's magnetic field is the strongest and second largest in the solar system, the solar wind interacts with the magnetosphere, extending it outward and impacting Jupiter's orbit. Jupiter's orbit houses some of our solar system's most dynamic moons, 97 of them in fact, including the Galilean satellites of Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. And not only do they revolve around Jupiter, three of them seem to leave an aural signature when they interact with Jupiter's magnetosphere, meaning that from Jupiter these northern or southern lights reflect the trails of the unique chemical compound of Io, Europa, and Ganymede. Callisto's signature, being furthest from Jupiter, still yet remains a mystery. Yet these moons carry so much more, each with their own unique landscapes and stories. We can consider how planets play a role in witchcraft through two existing frameworks, astronomy and astrology. Astronomy shares with us the story of a failed star, in whose wake a solar system was formed. It helps us understand and reveal patterns that exist within and outside of our daily, monthly, and yearly cycles by zooming out on time. Astrology tells about the energy rhythms in relation to ours. It tells us the stories of the longer cosmic dance. And it asks us to consider this planet, the Sage, known for being the planet of luck, optimism, goodwill, and abundance, is in fact perhaps aptly named for its role. No matter how you interpret the presence of this planetary giant, this almost star, the planets ask us to zoom out on time to look for the patterns underlying the cosmos, the bigger web, which we as witch, as weavers, tune into to work our magic.
Raise a glass, folks.
Huzzah! Huzzah!
It's time for my fourth topic of the year, elixirs!
I feel like this is so appropriate.
Elixir work is something I've dabbled in for a little while now. So my plan in choosing this for this year's topics was to see what I could take from what I've done with elixirs before and, you know, take it a step further in methodology and learning. But first, let's take a step back for a sec and talk about the topic of elixir magic in general. The word elixir is one of a family of concoction words in the witch's sphere.
Ooh, I like that.
Very
concoction
good.
Words.
Elixirs, potions, tonics, tinctures, the list goes on, right? And depending on the tradition you're following, you may find the same word has a few unique definitions. So here, just to kind of level set, here I am only referring to how we here at Atomic Witchcraft define elixir, which we define as an ingestible liquid creation, ingestible and liquid creation, which is developed and crafted with magical intent. Potions, to differentiate with like a different term that we use for us, they're similar, but these refer to concoctions which are not meant to be eaten or drank.
And please no drinking those.
And potions don't have to be liquid per se.
I mean, they can be sludge.
But they could be sludge,
yeah.
Right.
I've definitely made a sludge potion or two in my day.
Oh, yeah.
A six-year-old me.
Again, not ingestible, so we're not so worried about that.
40-year-old me. Not ingestible. Those are the big differences, friends. Like, one
really
is something you can,
like, that.
Put in your body, and the other one maybe don't put in or on your body. It's not made for that.
No. So given that definition, this means this topic of elixir magic means the developing and crafting of drinks, specifically with magical intent. This work looks like constantly seeking out that key ingredient to round out a recipe or perfecting a technique like an infusion, and even leveraging advanced preparation techniques like fat washing or aging or even distillation to arrive at elixirs that are handcrafted for specific aims and effects. My favorite thing about elixir work is in this highly intentional choice making of ingredients, equipment, and vessels. This deep focus on every little aspect of magical drink making results in something really singular and rich with intentful energy down to every last drop. And honestly, different every single time. You could follow the exact same thing, but because it's not that exact moment in time, it's going to come out a little different every time. So to recap, the basic idea here is develop your intent, then intentionally choose your ingredients, intentionally choose your methods for creating it, and your result will be an elixir crafted quite intentionally.
Quite literally.
And this general approach can be great for an elixir-based spell, crafting an elixir for a ritual, and even just for incorporating some magical intent in your everyday drink making, with that extra special element of care enveloping the process. So far in my own practice, I've created a few elixirs, and I really enjoyed this craft. It builds on my personal love for mixology and just working with creative drinkable recipes in general, alcoholic or non-alcoholic, just making fun drinks. As for specific techniques I've developed into, I've had fun with crafting bitters mixes in particular for myself, and that involves using infusions of key herb and root ingredients in alcohol. It's a patient process. It takes a few weeks to a couple months to complete, but the result is a powerfully concentrated blend that culminates in the effect that I'm looking for. Luckily, it's also something that doesn't require any particular challenging or specialized skills, just hunting for the right elements, mindfully working with them as you set them, and then simply waiting for the occasional good shake mixed in as the ingredients do their thing. I've also played around with leaning into the idea of crafting an elixir as telling a story.
Oh, I'm so excited about this.
A good story follows an arc of escalation and resolution to get across the intent and the message of its narrative. So I've chosen my elixir's main character, and then I consider what kind of presence they should have to be the primary goal of the elixir. So is this main character peaceful? Do they have confidence, or do they have clarity? And then based on that, I'll consider what a good beginning, middle, and end of this character's story should feel like. And this then translates into the preparation steps, the creation, the experience of the elixir's flavors, and then what experiences or mundane steps should follow to close out the story once you've had the elixir.
Because I am a super coffee nerd, this reminds me of how many baristas will approach a coffee competition, like a World Cup kind of thing, craft a story around a drink and tell that story as they are making their drink for the judges. So it's not just like, here's
what?
A drink.
I'm yeah. so they, it's, tuned in.
It's very cool. So I just like, I know a few folks, and I know a few folks personally who compete in these things, but there's a whole narrative that they write around this drink as they're making it. And it could be talking about the components. It could be a story around the drink. It could be a tale that they tell with the drink, but there is always this element of storytelling in this crafting. So that just, it just brought that to mind as you were talking about like story crafting and elixir work of this, these barista competitions.
Well, and I you know, not to give you all a sneak peek, but we're writing some Candle Night stories, and I was just thinking about how cool it would be to like eventually maybe craft beverages.
For each so night.
Cool. Yeah, for each night. Sorry. Or for yeah. each pillar, right? Like there is yeah. a witch's warrior one. Snap. And maybe that's just a recipe that we have as a grove and doesn't even have to come out for Candle Nights, but we could over Start. Time formulating yeah. those like, and they could be specific to our season, right? Because we also celebrate like Guardians is in the summer, so maybe that yeah, is more yeah. of like a juice and a that sort of blend, and then something yeah, in the you know for story, year. It's actually something warm and heated.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
Anyway, yeah. Love this idea. This is really cool.
Connecting stories with food. I mean, if you really nerd out about chefs' shows and documentaries and things, I mean, this shows up in gourmet. Like meal planning and sort of, I mean, there's so many examples, but just to say it, the idea of connecting story to like a recipe or a plan like this does not require extreme culinary skills or award-winning coffee crafting, competition level abilities. You could be doing this with three ingredients and one vessel and a lovely story in your mind. So all that said, my goal here, speaking of kind of like levels of skill, is to shift into a level two mindset. I've done a couple of things. I've used various methodologies in my elixirs. So I want to expand that territory a little bit, perhaps leaning into brewing a little bit. That's not really something I've chosen to do for elixirs before. And just expanding my overall elixirscape to include other elements of my practice even. So like, how could I incorporate a sigil onto the vessel I'm using, or think of familiars. I've learned a lot this year. So
well, I think even with familiars you could almost approach it from the story aspect as well, as like, what is a crow's beverage?
Yeah. Ooh. Oh yeah. Oh, there's so much to it. So okay, I'm gonna stop there. I want to ask a question on the methods point. I do know Alyssa's got some pretty killer kitchen skills, and I know Ash brews a lovely cup of tea. Have you yourself dabbled in these drinkable spells as well, or worked magic into food or drink-centric settings?
No, I haven't really done so extensively. I've dabbled in it on this sort of herbalism side of things, like through that lens, most specifically in the form of teas. So crafting like a nice blend of chamomile and mint for sleep aid, or some raspberry leaf tea for cramps, but not too much beyond that. I think my most spelled centric drinkable was the elixir that we all crafted together for the past summer solstice. That was so really fun. But I definitely lean into my like kitchen witchcraft when preparing a meal or snacks for other people, especially for a group. Feeding people is how I show love, and I put a lot of that into the food I make. I want people to feel welcome and warm, happy, and cared for, so I really intentionally weave that into my food. And I suppose it extends to drink when I prepare it in that sort of setting as well. Like I make a mulled wine every year around Christmas time that I sort of also put that energy and intent to as well. I want people to feel like really warm holiday fuzzies as they drink this mulled wine. But a like a an elixir sort of based ritual I've been curious about is specific tea rituals, especially around using like a gaiwan and doing the ritual of rinsing the leaves and watering your tea pet and like pouring a little bit out for the spirits. And there's a whole process and ritual with it that is like so interesting and so curious to me. And I really want to try, but I'm also really scared. I don't want to like tread into these waters sort of unfeeling. So I think that there's actually a couple of classes in the area that teach you how to do this. But that is something interesting to me of combining ritual and drink that I'm curious about.
That's so cool.
Well, I think for me, it hits on two points that Alyssa talks about a lot, which is wellness and community. So whether you're alone or with others, I think preparing beverages or food can be really comforting as a way to show care. Just like Alyssa was mentioning, all those sayings about food being an expression of love, even if you aren't cooking and just hosting, being able to provide food to community that you care for and about is just, I don't know, magical to me. So in that, I definitely focus on my intention when preparing that food or drink or laying out the food spreads. Intention helps people feel seen. And through feeling seen, people tend to relax into the situation. Yeah. And then, you know, with that, we get to be human together and less like two people interacting.
Yes.
We're just like being here and human.
Food and drink bridge the gap.
They do really bridge the gap. Wellness is the other key aspect for me, and this might be in caring for others or even just myself, and elixirs often play a big role in that. So whether it's a juice blend with a shot of vitamins or a warm cup of tea when a friend is distraught, there is a lot of potential here based on the goal or intent of the elixir. Even when we drink just like water, the elixir of life, if we focus on the intent, maybe a visual of cells becoming refreshed or HTO working its way into our cells, maybe it's focusing on that connection to water as an element as a whole and how it might help restore balance within us, both physically and metaphysically. So someone with a chronic pain and illness, I definitely include elixirs in my practice pretty regularly, but I've also just like simplified things a bit. So I don't have to get super fancy with ingredients. Like you said, it could be three things. And for me, it's really about getting those things down to something that's effective, even if it's a placebo effect and it's just something that soothes me, right? Even it doesn't have to like have medicinal properties. Although if you are pursuing that, make sure you're doing all your good research and that you check with your doctors and there's no complications and all that. But for me, I really like to use words as a big part of it. And then, of course, you know, aligning the elixir to the intent. You know, if I want something refreshing, I'm going to go for something that's cool or maybe even just water, right? Mm-hmm. Something soothing, I like something heavier and creamier. So kind of getting to know what your needs are and what your profiles are. And then really just visualizing that impact as I imbibe it. And sometimes I'm visualizing it on like a scientific level, not a magical, I see energy flowing,
but
actually
nourishing for my body.
I'm actually imagining my little cells and my little mitochondria interacting with those little HTO cells.
Doing their happy That's little, I just magic. Got water dance.
Yeah. I mean, you can look science videos up and kind of, we have this ability actually where we get to see so much of this inner world through microscopes, through digital imaging, through x-ray imaging, through a variety and all sorts of imaging. And so it becomes easier to then visualize, right? We have a sense of what that looks like.
Yeah.
Anyway, I do tie that deeply in with elixir work. And for me, it's part of that chronic illness and just kind of taking care of myself. So I guess my advice here would be, don't feel like it needs to be complicated. Like you said, to be effective, focus on the intention and simple spells can, you know, really get the job done.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as I've already been really excited to dive into this one, I've already been doing a little thinking on some initial ideas of how to pursue that particular focus of elixir work this time. My last elixir was one which involved some pretty basic gathering of ingredients, with one element involving freezing into ice cubes, which melted into the drink. So this time I want to build in a new methodology, something that aligns with the intent I've got for the elixir, which will then be used for a little spellcrafting and casting, as I've decided. Thinking on that a little more, I spent some time meditating and journaling on what I've been looking for as we enter into this darker half of the year now, and this phrase, found stillness, kept coming to mind. This idea of the value of inaction, of slowing down, being patient, kind of like we learned about in the Moss and Mushrooms episode recently, in order to allow what needs to take place to have the time it requires.
I feel like I've been saying this a lot lately, but I'm a big believer that things will happen when they should happen. Mm-hmm. And I know Yes, I am also a little bit of a procrastinator, but I procrastinate kind of with this in mind of like, I will know when it's ready to be done. I will, I will have a sense of when this thing is supposed to happen or come to fruition. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit like, I was actually talking about somebody with at work with this about how it's a little bit like sensing the tide of energy. And instead of pushing or trying to make something happen before it should, or, you know, putting a blockage in it, it's really just about riding it.
Yeah, the phrase, when the spirit moves you, comes to mind as we're talking about
That's
this.
Great.
I, too, approach procrastination, quote-unquote, in that way.
You know, we procrastinators are just following the tradition of Gandalf. We're never early, we're never late. We arrive precisely when we mean to.
It's true.
So, yes, that's inspiring me right now, and I'm thinking a lot of that intent. I'm still working on that intent a bit, but I think that's a general theme. And so along those lines, I'm going to spend the next moon cycle or so in mindfulness mode, thinking on, taking note on things that I connect with this intent theme, this story of found stillness. And I want to think of that kind of what is the main character of that recipe, who embodies that trait, and then sort of what surrounds that in sort of a beginning, middle, and end. And just asking questions like, what does stillness taste like? What does it look like? What does it smell like, feel like? Like, this is how I, from a very sensory method, go about choosing the ingredients and methods, which I'll use to craft up this elixir spell. So, like, the method should involve waiting. The method.
Well,
very
I imagine there's
going to
be some stillness of letting it be still.
It's got to do its thing. Yeah, like I can't, if I put my, if I keep working it and I keep, you know, messing around with it, it will not mature, it will not finish brewing, steeping, whatever. Like, it needs to do its thing. I need to take my hands off and wait. And so then I plan to craft and drink this elixir on the second new moon of my three lunar cycles, kind of going with new, as that too feels like a good moment of stillness from a lunar cycle standpoint.
Yeah, of course.
Well, of course, see if all this comes together as planned, as
it will come together when it should.
Exactly. I do love how these lunar cycles, these three lunar cycle spans, give us the space to have an idea, but also to let that idea progress and shift naturally with the ways life and circumstance pull it once it's set in motion. Regardless, though, of how it all turns out, I'm just excited to be focusing in on this topic that I already love and enjoy, and I get to share that experience here so we can all share in the fun. And so with that, any additional advice or ideas to keep in mind as I drink deep into this new adventure of elixirs?
I think it's really interesting that you were talking about doing something around stillness. And I know right now life is very busy for you, which is like the epitome of not still.
Yes.
And so I wonder how this elixir will kind of like, and we don't have the answer now, obviously. You don't have the answer now. But I'm curious to see how maybe this elixir can be how you find stillness by how you, you know, forcing yourself to take the 5 minutes it takes to be still to make it every day. If it's something like a tea or something like that, that then forces you to be still in the chaos of everything.
Yes. I think early on, as that phrase hit me, the image of like rock in a river kind of came to mind, of like, be willing to wait even when nothing around you says that's correct, or you may easily be persuaded, no, I gotta keep doing things. And it is this, what this elixir sort of grants in terms of like opening up my psyche and my sort of willingness is, no, recognize that this thing that you're working on, it needs time. Give it time.
Yeah, I actually get into this a little bit, and we're going to talk about it in the seasons, but sometimes we have to be the one to set the pace and the one to say like, no, actually, we can slow down, especially in this very capitalistic society where we are kind of driven by productivity and go, go, go. Really being able to say, no, actually, I am going to take this few minutes. Like, I have really been prioritizing making sure I take a lunch break, right?
Yes.
To just put that stop in the middle of the day.
I'm going to call out Ash for a second. She used to not.
I'm still
not
working
very often. I'm so proud of you.
But I am trying to take that time in the middle of the day. Part of it is, like, for me, I'm somebody that, like, I get in a motion and I just want to keep that motion going until I get to the end of the day. So I'm somebody that will, like, instead of taking a lunch break, I'll leave early. I have the luxury of doing that at my job. I know not everyone doesn't. So, But, you know, like being able to then just like also be like, no, I'm actually done for the day, or, you know, whatever. You setting the pace, I think, is really key. And this comes up when we talk about seasons, because not everybody lives in a place where seasons are as evident around them. Right. And so it really becomes about like, no, when we shift to darker days, we are going to slow down, even though in our capitalist society, holidays start to bombard us and we're like driven and told to consume. Yeah.
I think if there's a theme that has come out in this idea of found stillness, is at least just sort of to peel apart some various ways that this could go, is it is less about finding stillness in a moment of rest, and it is more about stillness for focus, for sort of paying attention and being engaged in that stillness, not sort of just not closing your eyes and like having a...
That's the eye in the middle of the eye of the hurricane, right? Exactly. Like you're still there, you're still present, but they're still taking that moment, even if it is to say like brew your 5-minute beverage, right? In that moment, using that to be aware, to use that as a like a grounding moment. Even sometimes like I use those moments to, that's my orientation moment, right? Like I'm letting my compass figure out where I need to go next.
Exactly.
I have to be still for that to happen.
I think that's exactly it. It's that you have to stop moving in order to make the right next step forward. And many things are going to work at their own pace that may be different than the pace that you've been careening on at the given moment, which is why I like connecting it to the moss and mushrooms things of like, they're on their own timeline, you know, and if you want to work with them, great, but you're going to need to adjust your pace in that moment. And not only is that okay, that is wonderful, because it gives you that chance to connect into what you're caring about in that moment. And I guess at the end of the day, this elixir is about caring about things.
A witch who embraces nature as part of their craft learns to live at its pace. From the rotation of the earth to its elliptical journey around the sun, the cosmic time follows no clock. Instead, it sets its own rhythm, one of cyclical balance. As the tides turn each quarter, we want to share with you the seasons of witch. I also want to start by saying that having grown up in areas where the seasonal shift is so much more subtle, it becomes even more important to hold the tides of those seasons within our practice and selves. Nature is doing those things. They just tend to be a little bit more subliminal. Often, this is where it can be helpful to look up and shape our seasons by the stars and that yearly cycle. Even if we don't hold astrology as part of our practice, there are still signs of time and change. And when the season is hard to tap into, it's okay to set the pace until you find alignment. For those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, we are now heading more deeply into the dark season. The season of the witch continues, now with a dash of holly jolly on top of our hibernation. This season may or may not include a weather change for you, but no matter what, we can all embrace the slowing of pace, even if the world is asking us to speed up. We can choose to say no, to say this year we are going to slow down, even if it's just in how we are present in activities. This allows us that time to be a bit more introspective, to turn inward. There is a reason that one of the most famous holiday stories is a ghost story. We can feel the veil's presence during this time when we walk closer to that liminal edge. I personally really lean into this, especially since moving to the Pacific Northwest and the long dark that sets in at about, 4 p.m. It makes for really long nights. Even when you are still kind of moving on the same routine and timeline as before, you're still having dinner at 6:30 or 7, and yet you still feel like you have like the longest night ever because the night started four hours ago.
It's 10 p.m., not 6.
Yes. It's intense. You know, and it asks for a shift, and with that I like to give in. It might be a time for me, at least, I enjoy more books or crafting and baking more, just sitting with a warm beverage and my furry friend. It also means watching nature change around and getting out there in safe ways. I have a lot of fond memories of growing up in the Colorado Rockies and waking up to snow heaps and animals grazing in our front yard, an easy source of food in the scarcity of the cold. It was a time of wood fireplaces and dogs coming in covered in icicles only to melt in front of the warmth of the hearth. It was as magical as it sounds, and so for me, this time holds those memories as well. All this together means this becomes a time when there's ritual in the everyday acts of the season, even things like shoveling snow. So, Jay, Alyssa, how is the seasonal shift in energy for you?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, this is when I personally really want to just slow down. I want nothing more than a cozy fire, a book, and a hot drink, and that's it. I mean, like you mentioned, here in the Pacific Northwest, this is the long dark. This is the time of year where not just us as witches, but most folks tend to hunker down and not want to leave their house after 5 p.m.
Yeah, according to Seattle Reddit, that's just what we're doing.
No, that's okay. This is it. This is the time. And then we'll see each other gratefully in the spring again.
Well, either that or you're really getting out and embracing the soggy weather, and it's like soggy weather, hot shower, then vibe.
Yes, exactly.
And just shout out to our Canadian neighbors and anybody even further north who are experiencing an even longer dark.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, peace be with you, friend.
The peace be with you.
You know, this is the time when the natural world is hunkering down as well, only to come out for those like brief periods of activity of like foraging on those sunny days. Or like, I love it when, you know, we have periods of gray and cold, and then all of a sudden there's an explosion of birds because it's sunny and they're all super happy. So, you know, just leaning into that rhythm of the slowing down despite the human pace and desire to speed up and up and up, especially amongst the holidays and things like that. A lot of things to do.
Yes, 100% agree with slowing down into this season. Forever and always, winter is my favorite season. Aww. Especially because of the slowing down. It was my first favorite season. It continues to be. Part of what I love here about living in the PNW is how similar winter feels to where Alyssa and I grew up in the northeast of the U.S. Not quite as much snow, but it's a similar, like you said, the weather doesn't change for everybody. It does in a similar way for us here. To me, there's not just a slowing down, but like this feeling of quiet and focus too. Probably my earliest witchiest memory that I can conjure up was long before I began this practice, as a teenager, awestruck by the sight of this brilliant full moon in the middle of January, which I now know is the wolf full moon. And it was just this cold, crisp night, and you could see every little detail on the moon. And I was frozen. I think I was walking out to like the end of my driveway to check the mail. I hadn't checked the mail earlier in the day, and it was my job to do it that day, so I just decided to walk out, and it just blew me away. And so for the rhythm of my practice, I try to slow down but like zoom in a bit in this moment and focus on appreciating just the magical seasonal uniqueness all around, and zooming in a little bit inward as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you can get to zoom in while snowflakes are falling.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great zoom in, right?
Like I said, favorite season.
Yeah, considering here in the Seattle area, snow plows don't really come around all that often except for on the main roads. So when it snows here, we're hunkered in quite literally.
The ice makes it hard to get out.
And I love it.
Yeah, it's that feeling of school days.
I think there's one plow in the Seattle metro area. Sure, and I don't
I'm sorry to the KC metro folks.
Oh no, you guys all agree.
I don't know. Oh no, I think it's intentional. Because I think they too are, you know, they want that day. They want that snow day.
Everybody wants the snow day. Who doesn't want the big snow day? And during this time, we will have a few rituals. We'll have candle nights, which will really kick off with the long night and the winter solstice, and then roll into the 12 nights of candle nights. But we also celebrate midwinter. And so it's a season really ripe with the potential for putting ritual in the everyday, from these little activities that we talked about, like pulling out winter coats and watching familiar movies, to those like bigger moments. And for this season, at least for me, it's just, you know, ripe with ritual. For those of us on the Atomic team, Candle Nights is those 13 nights that starts with the long night before winter solstice, like I mentioned, and then the 12 nights following. We use this time to connect, tell stories, and even do a bit of reflecting on what it means to be witch to us. We all include a little bit of secular rituals we grew up with as well. Then for midwinter, we focus more on the stillness of the season, leaning into rest as a time of dreaming and reflecting. It's the seed that is about to be planted. And so with that, we start to consider our witches web topics for the year and how we're hoping to show up in our lives for the coming season. Now, we just did a whole little episode and workshop on these seasonal festivals, so I highly encourage you listening to those. We each have our own little ways and takes, and we encourage you to fill your festivals with rituals that feel comfortable and inclusive to your life and practice. Now, Jay, Alyssa, we often do rituals together, which means we share some of the things I just mentioned. But outside of that, what are some ways that you like to celebrate?
Yeah, I mean, we talked quite a bit about this in episode 153, so I'll just kind of keep it a little bit brief here so as to not repeat myself from last time. But the two main ones for me this time of year are the winter solstice and candle nights specifically. Like, midwinter for rest is great, but these are the two sort of big ones. You know, I usually observe a sunset, sunrise ritual for that long night, and solstice kind of welcome back the light And for candle nights, yeah, I like to do something to mark each night, whether it's reflecting and tension setting or just spending time being like really present and really mindful. And, you know, because I grew up with it, I still love it. I celebrate Christmas season as well, it just in a very secular way. We have a Christmas tree and Christmas morning rituals, usually involving like Irish coffee and the Lord of the Rings marathon.
Oh, yeah.
And if I didn't have a mischievous cat, I would definitely leave out milk and cookies for Santa. That's one of my favorite like wintertime rituals from a kid. Just like this kindly old elf that comes and visits your home once upon a year to bring joy. This offering.
You do know that not all traditions are about a kindly old elf.
I know. Okay. We do have the Krampus.
But, you know, I gotta say, I try to make it up all night on the longest night. And if I'm honest, like, I can't. I know I can. I know if I just want to. Effort. I tend to be a night owl. I could do it. But it's that gosh darn responsibility demon inside me whispering, you do need some energy tomorrow for that thing you need to do. And so, like, that tends to
okay, so it sounds like
convince
we,
me.
Maybe the key is to not have anything to do on that day.
Ah.
It's just a day of rest.
That sounds perfect. For the hours we do stay up so far, the only thing I will add to what we've already said is there's nothing like a rewatch of movies like Klaus to be reminded of the magic of this season and the wonderful folklore that features it. As for candle nights, I think back to that full moon that struck me as a teen. So for like those 12 nights, I consider myself struck by moonlight into focus of those 12 nights. And I remember that the moon is a mirror of the sun for us. And so it kind of sets me up in this spirit of like, there's a spotlight on inner reflection. And I just kind of think in that theme as we do the things that we do, like writing letters to ourselves and enjoying time with family and, you know, and friends, however we're able to.
So from rituals to altars, of course, these sacred spaces might reflect things like candle nights, Yule, or midwinter, but they also offer an opportunity to reflect the season as it is. For some, this will look like snow or rain. Others might see something more subtle, like a plant or a flower that only blooms during this time. Perhaps it's strictly the celestial skies that really note the shift. There are so many ways to track and honor time on our altars. For me personally, I do tend to lean more into the popular imagery. Holly, doves, snowflakes, and a little snow figures. You know, for me, it's really a little bit of a tchotchke vibe shift. It kind of happens with my house decor as well. Yes. And I switch out my brooms and my wreath on my door. Each one, like my wreath on my door is very white and red and focuses on the doves. And then, you know, my broom has got a little bit more of the actual like holly vibe in it. What about you two? How do you two switch up your altars?
I mean, for my altar, I dispose of like any autumnal bits that are still hanging around, like pumpkins and leaves and stuff, in a respectful manner. You know, I usually return these items to the earth with a thank you, and sort of carry them on my way. And then I do my quarterly altar clean and tidy and just kind of reset, putting away items I don't need, taking others out that I do want. And for winter specific, I usually bring in some like small fresh evergreen branches, which I try to harvest from what's like been blown down rather than taking directly from a tree. Usually by this time we've had a few windstorms, so there'll be stuff laying on the ground ready to harvest.
Yes, it's not difficult.
It's not difficult to find. And then for like house decor, it usually goes from Halloween / fall to winter around December 1st-ish. I usually cling on to Halloween for a good portion of November.
Yeah, me too. It'll switch here soon. And, you know, with that goes up the tree and all that kind of stuff.
It's hard for me to let go. It's my favorite holiday. So I'm always just like, but no, as the rest of the world is singing Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas, you know. I love having evergreen, whether real or reusable, having that sort of imagery in my home. So that usually gets put up around the house. And I also love fairy lights, that soft, twinkly lighting.
Me too.
My favorite, so I hang that up all around as well. And then we do the Christmas tree later in the season, a little bit closer to like towards the end of December. We always try to opt for a real one, which, you know, no shame on fake ones. They have their place. They just don't feel the same to me personally.
Hey, I'm going to advocate as a person with allergies. I have tried so many years to have a real one, and man, is it just not worth the misery that I go through.
It's
so
a lot
I
of
have,
clean
I
too.
Have to, yeah, it is. Yep. So I do have a fake tree. I do try to get wreaths or boughs that I can have. Sometimes I'll put a bough by my front doorstep something like that so that I can still have that smell, but it's not in the house where I'm like sitting. Like, I live in a small space, so if I want to sit in, like, I have to sit next to my Christmas tree, so like it is in my face.
Mm-hmm.
So
And, you know, I feel like there's always this question between what's more environmentally friendly, getting the real tree or having a not real tree. And honestly,
it's a wash.
It's a wash. It's like, well, you cut down a tree. That's not great. But, well, you have a tree that's manufactured. Well, that's not great. But that tree then lasts you years and years and years, and you reuse it. I had the same tree. You know.
Which is kind of fun because sometimes I'll pull it out and I'll, have forgotten to take something out of the tree before I put it away. And it's like little gifts that come back.
I love that.
Yes. I mean, I will say I grew up with a tree that my family still uses. And the amount of decades that I'm into my life so far, that's a pretty nice longevity on that one fake tree. So
versus whatever, how many ever years that would be of cutting down
trees. How many trees did you cut down in those years?
Okay, make me feel bad.
Well, hey, don't feel bad. Don't feel bad.
Don't feel bad at all. It's just a choice. I too like to pare things down and switch over for the season. But I pare way down on my altar for the season. I go kind of minimal.
Ooh.
A little bit of a contrast to the decor of the rest of the house and the world around.
Which tends to be maximal.
Which tends to be more maximalist. I allow the autumnal elements to fall away. And I kind of hone in my sacred space to the state of quiet focus.
Very nice.
But one thing I don't tend to skip on are two intangible elements on my altar, and that is wintry scents. I love pine and cinnamon provided via candle or incense, and ample music of the vocal variety. Ooh. Winter is the time of singing to me more than any other time of the year, so I tend to build that into my whole atmosphere. Like if I'm at my altar, if I'm doing any kind of work, if I'm meditating, it's not just there's always some kind of music involved, but at this in winter, it's singing. It's always singing, and usually I'll do a little singing as well.
And I think that brings us back to, you know, our witchcraft, which I actually think that we've taken on a pretty apt set of web topics for this winter season, with Jay doing elixirs and Alyssa's doing ice, and I'm trying my hand at working at Fossil and Bone. I also think that because we're really drawn to fire at this time, crafts involving flames specifically could be really apt focus during this time. Mm. What other craft paths might you think would be a good, like, wintertime focus?
Yeah, I mean, like, for me personally, my practice tends to go a little bit quieter during the winter, a little bit more of a hibernation. It becomes less about being, like, really active in outer work and more focused on, like, the inner work. So for me, this is meditation, divination, reflecting on what I've done in this past year and dwelling on sort of what's ahead, sort of like a pre-work to the seed planting that'll then happen in the spring. Outside of that, you know, focusing on rest and going with the cycles of the season. But yeah, I do tend to balance out this season, lean into the fire, the candles, the fake little gas fireplace we have in our wall and things like that.
I use my TV fireplace.
Yes, we love a good TV fireplace.
Yes. Despite my water-based elixir magic, that is, I think it is typically a winter tradition for me, I do tend to listen, lean into the fire in the air, fire magic, candle magic, music, aroma, song, telling stories, all of that is very much of this season. Because, you know, yes, winter tends to have this water and earth feel, sunken down, rain, snow, ice, tree bark standing out against that. So I balance into my fire and air, which, I mean, they tend to be my two strongest elements. So, like, maybe that's why winter's my favorite season. Oh. Sort of this whole connection there.
It's a good connection. And, you know, moving into the mundane, I sometimes find that this part is actually the biggest challenge for me during this time, because what I want is to slow down. But the holiday grind of capitalism, which we've mentioned, really pushes against that. So over the years, I've really been slowly working on paring things down as far as expectations and gatherings. And with that, I love walking holiday tree lots as like a fun little mundane slow down. Even though I don't end up purchasing a tree, I still love the smell and like the tradition of that. And then, you know, decorating the tree. I'm somebody that gets the tree, you know, because it's a fake tree, I can pull it out early November, which I also love. I've had situations where we've gotten the tree too early, and by the time you get it to the solstice, it's like crispy.
Yeah. No one wants a crispy tree.
Nobody wants a crispy tree. And this was times when I lived in Arizona, mind you. So you, by the time the tree gets to you, it's already pretty crispy, and then it gets even more crispy. It literally fell down that holiday. It's a story. But the fake tree I can pull out, you know, at the end of November, I spend time decorating it. I have a little holiday village that I pull out that I really enjoy. So, you know, I use this time to really, you know, zhuzh the space and make it feel like a winter wonderland. And for me, that's how I embrace it on a mundane level. There's definitely elements of like, you know, witchy vibe to that that I try to imbue. But for most part, you know, that's just me loving the season. What about you all?
Well, yeah, there's that magic of the season. We literally say that. So this time of year, whether people intend it to or not, is inherently witchy because we're always talking about the magic of the season. But yeah, for me, mundane. I mean, this is a time of year for gathering with your people. And, you know, it doesn't have to be raucous holiday parties. It could be. But this is, you know, gathering for hot meals and sharing gratitude for the past year, or having like candlelit parties where you stash your phones away so none of you are distracted and you play board games or just have a good conversation, things like that. You know, the old gathering by the fire to tell Yuletide tales kind of vibe, mm-hmm. if you will. But yeah, you know, just really simple things like that, bringing it back to community.
Yep, 100% on board with Alyssa. The same things here. This is the season of magic. This is the time to connect with friends and family and the same things that you value, and they might even align with the same things that you value and practice in your craft. You know, leaning into natural cycles, appreciating shared warmth and community together. I'll bring the guitar, you all bring your untrained voices, and we'll all have a grand old time with hot cocoa in hand, right? That's all that needs to be.
I will also add a mundane activity that I forgot that I love. If it happens to happen and we get snow, I love making me a good old snowman.
Yes, of course.
Well, I guess eventually, sometimes, some years we don't get snow, but most years we get at least a little bit of snow.
Even if it's a tiny little snowman. Mm-hmm. I just love getting out there and kind of playing with it. It's fun.
Now, we know not all of us witches are out of the broom closet, or maybe we are, but we still need to be a little bit more subtle in some of our activities. Or maybe you want to include your family, but they aren't ready for the full witchy experience yet, whether due to age or interest. There are some great ways you can still connect during this season, and perhaps this season, maybe more than most, offers a lot of public alignment with personal traditions, at least for me, from mm-hmm. decorating holiday trees to gatherings, from baking yummy treats, you know, looking at Christmas lights. I think this was, in fact, the first holiday festival that I was really able to really start celebrating a bit more openly in my broom-closeted youth, and hey, there's literally a song about the 12 nights, so.
Well, and, you know, a lot of what we think of as, quote, traditional Christmas traditions are actually more pagan traditions.
Yes, they are.
The bringing in of the evergreen. The
Well, that's what I mean, is like a lot of our stuff out there, it's that the public align with personal traditions is also a public alignment with, like, just pagan traditions in general. Everything mm-hmm. from having trees and Yule logs to even decorating and using the globes and the balls, right? So there are things that have become, you know, synonymous with Christmas, and actually that's really not at all Christmas. So it's okay to reclaim that holiday, even if you have to do it kind of low-key. But if you do want some company, you can join us for candle nights here around the audio hearth, where we'll be putting out some stories. So stay tuned. Looking forward to sharing that all with you this season. And it's been such a pleasure sharing with you the seasons of Witch. Resistance Radio, Warrior Witch tuning in to bring you ways mundane and magical to fight fascism, kick capitalism, protest patriarchy, and converge with community. All while we decolonize, deprogram, and fight for anti-racism, equal rights, and trans lives. And of course, knowing when to rest and regroup, for that in itself is an act of rebellion. This lunar cycle, we want to tune into the idea of being prepared, without being panicked. This isn't about doomsday prepping, but it is about knowing where and how you can be prepared to help mitigate risk in these changing times. I'm going to start out simple with first aid and CPR training. This is just a damn useful skill, and if you can get trained on all age types, it's worth it. It includes not only how to help during things like heart attacks and strokes, but also can include training on wound care, especially for simple wounds. Now, I'm going to say this with the warning that you should always seek medical advice and care when possible, but as hospitals around the country close and healthcare becomes more and more expensive, think of first aid and CPR training as your first round great risk mitigator. Now, if you are someone who does well in high stress, health and safety related scenarios, you can take this one step further and become trained for bigger national disaster and community trauma events. Then, outside of medical things, consider what would happen if your power went out for an extended period of time. How are you prepared to deal with those things? Do you have flashlights, candles? What about food that doesn't require cooking? Or do you have camping gear that you could make sure is up to snuff so that you could use it in a pinch? This also includes preparing ahead on any medications or specialty items. In fact, I recommend everyone make an emergency backpack. I like to make mine red, but any bright color will do, and fill it with key items you would need in an emergency. And I say key because backpacks are limited in size, but the goal is so that it can travel with you should you need to move locations quickly. Speaking of moving locations, this is a reminder that knowing how to read a compass and having an up-to-date physical map with a list of addresses of your nearest hospital, fire station, grocery store, medical supply, and other key locations, you know, like maybe the address of a nearby family or friend. So many folks these days rely on their phones, but a simple satellite outage could impair our usage, leaving us literally directionless and without communication. Then, back at home, for supplies, consider a box that might be more permanent, to include bigger food items, gallons of water, things to make fire, even a water purification system, backup flashlights or batteries, a multi-tool or knife, any number of survival-type items that are important to not only have, but know how to use. While the goal is to never have to use them, this is one of those things that in my book applies the, like, better safe than sorry quip. Then, zooming out even further, we can look at how our spaces offer the opportunity to prepare.
Yeah, a great way to be prepared is to learn how to grow your own food. There's been a trend going around since roughly the beginning of 2025 called resistance gardening. This is an approach to growing food and plants inspired by the victory gardens that sprung up across the United States during World War I and II. It was a way to supplement a family's food sources during leaner times when grocery stores may not have had a robust stock. Resistance gardening takes this concept and adds a layer of growing as an act of rebellion to it. So it may not just be vegetables and other edible plants, but could include native plants and flowers beneficial to pollinators, which in turn help your plants. It's also a movement that encourages you to either be rid of or reduce outdoor space taken up by lawns. And here I will define lawns as over-fertilized monoculture kind and not the ones filled with beneficial grasses and small flowers. Getting started in gardening can be as simple as picking up some books from your library, watching some YouTube videos, or even attending master gardener talks at nurseries or farmers markets. You can begin in your yard by building garden boxes on your balcony and planters, or by getting a plot in a community garden. If this is your first time gardening, especially food, pick things that are easy to grow. Greens like lettuce and kale, potatoes, peas, and if you live in the right climate, small tomatoes like cherries or sungolds. If you have the ability and space to do so, you can plant fruit trees and bushes that will last a long time and repeatedly produce. Also, grow things that you will eat. If you don't like Swiss chard, don't grow it. This ensures food won't go to waste. Additionally, if you have an excess of food, put some out for your neighbors. This could be a table you set up or a permanent free food stand. Now, you're growing all of this food, and it's important to learn how to store it so that it lasts longer and you have some saved throughout the year. Properly storing produce is one of those things that not a lot of people know how to do very well, but it's easy to learn with a quick Google search. For example, potatoes and onions both need to be stored in cool, dark places, but did you know that you can't store them together? Onions release a gas that causes potatoes to rot faster, and potatoes release moisture, causing onions to rot faster. It's kind of a mutually assured destruction situation. But besides just storing food properly, you can also look into preservation techniques. Dehydrating, vacuum sealing, canning, freezing are all great methods, though some of them require some additional equipment. I do want to touch on canning real quick, because I have seen trends going around of something called, quote, rebel canning, which uses alternative methods to classic water bath or pressure canning as a preservation technique. I do not recommend using any canning method or recipe that has not been thoroughly tested and vetted, as improperly canned food will make you incredibly sick. I recommend using sources like the Ball Mason Jar website or any of their books that have safe, tested, and vetted methods. There's also buying and storing non-perishable budget foods. My grandma basically had a doomsday-level stock of cheap non-perishables in two different pantries in her basement. Things like rice, beans, canned veggies, pasta, things that wouldn't expire for years. Now, not all of us have that kind of space, but it may be a good idea to carve out space in your pantry or a small cabinet for budget-friendly non-perishables. After all, rice and beans make a complete protein, and a bag of each doesn't cost that much. Add some to your cart next time you go grocery shopping to have on hand. If you go in on a Costco membership with your family or roommates, you can get bigger amounts of non-perishables for a better value. If you need some low-cost meal recipes, looking at books and resources from the Depression or other recession times is a great idea. There's a creator on Instagram we like named Kiki Ruff that shows you step by step how to make these budget-friendly meals. Another great skill to build is learning how to repair your items like clothes, furniture, anything you might just buy a new one of to replace with the damaged one. I genuinely believe that everybody should learn really basic sewing skills. And I don't even mean going out and investing in a sewing machine, though that's not necessarily a bad idea. I mean just getting used to needle and thread and being able to do things like put back on a button or patch a hole. These skills have kept so many of my clothes in rotation that someone else may have just thrown away. It's a great way to save money and be more environmentally friendly. You can pick up some low-cost supplies at a thrift store to get you going. In order to learn these skills, you can search around on YouTube, check out some books from the library, or see if there are any free groups or classes at your library or community center. Then start learning more repair skills, like fixing chairs, putting back together a chip plate. Heck, you could even look into repairing small electronics. If you don't feel uncomfortable with bigger fixes, many communities host local repair events or fix-it cafes. Here you can bring your broken or damaged items and someone who is adept at making the repair can help you out. One of the many, many reasons why leaning into community resources is such an important asset.
Sometimes skill building is about tapping into old skills you haven't used in a while, like cultivating a rich and fun library of the movies and music you love without the need for a streaming service. Yep. For those of us who built out magnificent binders of DVDs and CDs and Blu-rays and never got rid of them, you've just got to do the work of figuring out where you squirreled it away. Right now, many of the major media and streaming corporations have chosen to either invest deeply in this terrible administration with the short-sighted hopes of government contracts or tax breaks, and they're banking on it being good for their bottom line. Don't give them that satisfaction. Leaning into physical copies of media allows you to cut your ties to those organizations and save that monthly subscription price for something more meaningful, like your own finances, or perhaps that wonderful community food bank that needs extra donations right now. But on top of the vote your wallet benefits, switching to physical media can also provide technical stability in not needing to rely on internet service and continuity for access to your favorite movies, music, and so on. With major cuts being made to many government agencies and the impacts of the recent and lengthy government shutdown, recently ended, but who knows when the next one will come around, it's not a bad idea to be able to entertain yourself without Wi-Fi or electricity, for that matter. Battery-powered stereos are worthwhile to have around when you need them. And hey, maybe it's a good time to finally pick up that dusty guitar you haven't played in forever and learn a few chords. And of course, the pleasure of a good book needs no plugs or powered connections whatsoever. And on the note of national services becoming unreliable, unfortunately, there's some pretty major things that our communities rely upon to ensure safety and stability, perhaps none more than the National Weather Service. Weather prediction saves lives. There's no hyperbole needed there. And admittedly, there's no easy replacement for a National Weather Service, which leverages satellites and advanced radar and detection systems to provide precise and accurate information at all times. But we humans have lived here much longer than these systems, and there are still things you can do to keep yourself informed and catch when storms or other kinds of dangerous conditions are on the way. As Tristan Gooley points out in one of our many book club books from earlier this year, How to Read Water, our observational skills can tell us a lot of helpful information about the world around us if we train ourselves to detect the specific patterns and signs, saying, in the long era before satellites aided weather forecasters, the behavior of the sea was often the best early warning system of danger to come. For instance, if you're near a coastal area, he explains how a storm will generate a swell that will quickly outrun the storm itself. So you should expect a large swell, an increase in the tide, the height of the tide, to arrive ahead of serious weather depression and its storms. Conversely, if the horizon shows dark skies approaching but the seas remain calm and level, it's very unlikely that the dark clouds mean anything more than a local patch of rain. We can also observe animal behavior to help us predict weather just as they do. For instance, the phrase, if birds fly low, expect rain and a blow, is actually quite accurate. Of course, low-flying birds do not always foretell bad weather, but birds can detect the subtle decreases in air pressure that accompany storms and alter their flight paths accordingly. Birds need to fly fast and efficiently to conserve their energy, so they settle into sweet spots where the air is thin. When weather is good, domes of high air pressure push these sweet spots up into the air, so birds fly higher. However, when air pressure drops before the weather gets bad, so do the sweet spots, and the birds then look for them down low. Since low pressure is associated with storms, low-flying birds may indeed signal rain and a blow. We may not have the full convenience that high technology can bring us, but our own observational skills can not only help us out when tech isn't around, but in general, help us appreciate the natural patterns of the world around us. So, double positive here, I say.
And that being said, high technology is not the only technology. And long before cellular towers, we relied on radio waves, antenna, and telegram cables. A throwback to the days of Morse code, signal towers, and even my favorite, ham radio. And even going less into history, you know, I remember these days when we had the good old landline telephone, the telephone poles that span our continent that allow for us to communicate without the need for satellites. In fact, having grown up in the days of landlines, I have actually started to treat my cell phone more like a landline. It is connected to the wall in not nearly a convenient enough place that I have to go to use it. Maybe it's time to go fully back. I do kind of miss those days.
I dream of the days of the landline often.
I dream of the days of the computer room.
Yeah, the time when you went to the computer. Yeah.
That's where the computer was.
I'm really, you know, as I get older, the more I'm kind of like reinforcing those things. I don't see a reason not to. These older sources of communication, along with our friends, the carrier pigeons, served us for decades before we transitioned over to modern forms. You know, something worth considering when we talk about staying connected when those high technology systems start to fail us. Now, all of today's episode to say it never hurts to be prepared. There is, at this current time, no cause for major alarm. But oftentimes, in a world when we feel anxious and unable to control the bigger things, we can bring a sense of control to our sphere of influence by being prepared for the things that might worry us most. Your action this lunar cycle is to get prepared. So some things you might do: take a CPR and first aid class, look into community support during emergency events, get a map and a compass, learn how to get places, and note your very important locations. Start a resistance garden. Learn how to properly store food. Find your local makers and repair shops. Learn to sew. Switch to physical media. And tune into the weather. Learn those signs.
And that's our New Moon Brew on elixirs. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll return for a full moon focus episode coming up, where I'll round out this fourth subject of mine and let you know how my brewing up some stillness has gone for me.
In the meantime, join us on Patreon for podcast updates and team news. It's free to join, and there are lots of resources to explore.
And if you're interested in community, you can always find us on our Discord server. Links to join are in the episode info.
And until next time,
keep your world witchy.